right? If you don't want to do it or you're not inspired to do something, you're not going to make that change. And so if somebody thinks their views align with Dave Ramsey's and they want to be, you know, debt-free and only pay cash for things, you know, and have a $1,000 emergency fund and what have you, at least they're taking steps forward rather than just not doing anything at all.
Welcome to Gen Z Green, where we talk personal finance and investing for the new generation of wealth builders. I'm your host, Chris Pratt. We have a really special guest today. She has been a trusted go-to source for journalists and media outlets to break down complex topics in layman's language, as featured in CNBC, Discover, and Reuters, just to name a few. She's a certified financial planner and CFA charter holder. We'll talk about what that is a little later. She's Main Street born, Wall Street bred, and she's a finance expert, a finance wellness advocate, and the founder of Rise Up. Her name is Tara Falcone. Welcome to the show, Tara.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Now, you have a background that I don't want to characterize for you. I just want to let you, you know, talk about it and share your story. But you have quite an amazing, you know, maybe you'd want to call it sad history and story and background to how you got here today. Just curious if you want to talk a little bit about what your life was like growing up and how you ended up getting to your CFP. Just start, like, what was your life like growing up?
Yeah, sure. So it was rocky, to say the least. I am the product of multiple divorces in my family. Actually, my mother, who I started living with, is on her fifth marriage right now. Crazily enough, I, you know, love her husband now. His name is Dwight. He's fantastic. Yeah. I grew up in kind of a small family in rural Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, kind of in that tri-state area. When I was 2 years old, my parents divorced. And then my mother went on to marry someone else. And then a few years later married someone else. And when I was nine, I kind of had the, you know, self-awareness at a very young age to realize that that level of instability was just not healthy for me. I operate on schedules and routine and things like that. And just all of that uncertainty swirling around me was really, really unhealthy. So I asked when I was 9 years old, if I could move to Michigan to live with my dad and my stepmom. And my mother knew that that's, you know, ultimately what was best for me. She granted that. And so I moved to Michigan to live with my father and my stepmom. And then just about a year later, my dad got kidney disease. It runs in our family. And so he had to go on dialysis. He needed a kidney transplant. And then a couple of years later, while he was still waiting for a kidney transplant, he developed congestive heart failure. And he ended up passing away when I was 13 years old. He was only 36 and my stepmom was only 30 years old. And so as my stepmom and I, you know, a 30-year-old and a 13-year-old left to kind of pick up the pieces. My dad was the breadwinner. Unfortunately, there was no life insurance. There had been a lot of debt racked up while he was sick. And so, you know, my stepmom and I were just there trying to keep a roof over our head and trying to, you know, deal with the grief that we were feeling at the same time. And actually, November 19th, which was very, you know, recent, is actually the 18th anniversary of his passing. It's crazy to think that it's been 18 years. But yeah, so, you know, at 13 years old, I'd grow up a lot faster than I think a lot of kids my age. And, you know, at 14 years old, I started working to help support the household, to pay for things that I needed. 14 years old at the time was the youngest you could start working for W-2 wages in Michigan. So I started working at the local ice cream shop that my father used to take me to. And I worked my way all through high school. I'm upgraded kind of to become a waitress at the local diner my sophomore year of high school. And, you know, I just worked. I worked to help pay the bills. I worked to help, you know, try to pay my way, you know, for car and gas and insurance and just all of those types of things, and had to sacrifice a lot with, you know, not going to sporting events or going out with friends or not playing sports and just all those kinds of things. But ultimately, I channeled all of the negative energy that I had from my dad's passing into my schoolwork, because that was where I felt I had control. So again, kind of this, you know, this theme of not doing well with uncertainty and instability. So I channeled all of my negative energy into my schoolwork, and I ended up graduating, you know, despite working all the time and having all of this stuff going on outside of school, I graduated as valedictorian of my class. And let's see, midway through my senior year, the guidance counselor called me down and she had asked me, you know, why have you only applied to schools in Michigan? You know, we feel like there are other schools that you could definitely get into. You have a stellar transcript, you know, you're a great student, you know, what's going on? And I said, well, you know, frankly, I can't afford to go anywhere else. I can barely, you know, afford what is down the pipe with like a state school here in Michigan. I have some merit scholarships that I'm going to try to use, but otherwise, you know, I just feel like anything else is outside of my financial reach. And she said that they had recently received an email from, you know, schools like Harvard and Yale talking about this need-based financial aid program that they had, where essentially if you and your family fall below a certain income level, you basically get a full ride scholarship to the university. And they're like, you know, you could get into a school like that, but you just have to have the confidence to apply. And this was 2 weeks before the application was due. And so some wonderful teachers that helped me get all of those materials together and letters of recommendation and essays and things. And lo and behold, I got into Yale. And they offered to pay everything, far more than any school in Michigan had offered. And I took a huge leap of faith and I went to Yale as a bright-eyed 18-year-old. Where do you want me to go from there? There's a lot that transpired after that.
That was a good a good story of your life. And of course, I think I and everyone listening are very sorry about your father's passing, and that absolutely, you know, breaks my heart. My mother's mother, my grandmother, passed when my mom was 12, and she had a very similar story of kind of having to work at a very young age and really relying on education for upward mobility and, you know, for a path forward. And it's so important. And I think for, you know, for someone like her, and maybe like you even, student loans, for instance, which we talk about a lot on this show, were not at the forefront of her mind. No. She was like, you know, I just want to, you know, make money and make real money and get out of poverty and be able to provide for my family. I know that has been an inspiration for me. And I know that you're an inspiration for everyone listening to this show right now, certainly. So you went to college, you started your undergrad as a pre-med student, but you ended up today as a certified financial planner and CFA charter holder. How did that happen?
Yeah, it's very, very different. So because my father passed away and we went through all of these experiences with him being in the hospital and needing transplants and not having the best healthcare sometimes, which I felt at a younger age that led to his demise, unfortunately. So I was kind of on this like hell-bent path to avenge his death as, you know, an 18, 19-year-old. And I just didn't.
I would be too.
Yeah. I was angry. I was very, very mad. And, you know, that's one of the early stages of grief is anger. And I was living in it. So, you know, I was really, really just dedicated to becoming a better doctor than he had had. So, you know, I took organic chemistry. I took, you know, biochemistry and biology and all of these classes, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And I was, you know, absolutely, you know, planning to become a doctor. I was actually a Spanish major alongside because Yale doesn't have pre-professional degrees. So half of my classes were all very like heavy science classes and the other half were all in Spanish, which was really cool. But yeah, I got to the end of my senior year and I was having this resistance to applying for the MCAT, which is essentially like the placement exam for medical school that you have to take. It's like the SAT for medical school, basically. And I was having a ton of resistance to that.
I think harder, but yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Definitely like way harder. Absolutely.
A buddy of mine is actually, he's taken a couple and he's been studying to retake it. And I mean, it's just, not a fun time.
Not at all. And like so many of my peers were taking entire summers off just to study for this exam and then taking it at the end of the summer before they started school again. And I didn't have that luxury. I had to work all summer, full time, you know, 40 plus hours a week just to, you know, again, support myself. And so I hadn't had the time to study for the exam yet. I was feeling a ton of resistance to just registering, you know, just putting a mark on my calendar that, hey, I'm taking the exam on this date. And it's also not, you know, an inexpensive endeavor to register for the exam, to get all of the books and study materials that you need. And I just really couldn't afford it. And I couldn't figure out why I was having such resistance. Obviously the money side of it was one thing, but there was this emotional side that was really holding me back. And that was in February of my senior year, just a few months before graduation. And I remember so clearly, and it sounds hokey to anybody who maybe doesn't believe something like this, but I went to sleep one February night in 2011. And I had a dream where my dad essentially came to me and said, you know, I don't want you to live your life for me anymore. I need you to figure out what you're passionate about and go and chase that. Mm. And I woke up the next morning thinking like, wow, okay. I guess I don't want to be a doctor anymore, but what do? I have a Spanish major. Like, am I, you know, like my pre-med stuff only counts for, you know, something if I want to go to medical school.
Right.
Am I going to become a teacher, like a Spanish teacher at a high school? Am I going to go on to get a grad degree? What am I going to do? And at the time, a lot of my friends and my then boyfriend, who's now my husband, were working in finance. They had done these internships in New York City on Wall Street, in banking and, you know, different areas of finance. And I was really intrigued by what they were doing because money was something that had always stressed me out my entire life.
Right.
I had very negative experiences with money growing up and up until that point. And so it was really intriguing to me that there was an entire industry dedicated to something that I felt completely out of sorts with. And I was broke. I couldn't afford to apply to medical school anyway, even if I wanted to. And I knew I had to get a job, right? I didn't want to, in my mind, take a step back by going back to Michigan for a year after I graduated to kind of figure stuff out.
So did you have to do more school?
No. So here's what happened. I applied to any job that was listed still on the student job board that had the name finance anywhere in it. Looking back, I was applying to a myriad of things that are completely unrelated, but I didn't know at the time because I didn't know what I didn't know. And I ended up applying to this one small hedge fund, which is a specific kind of investment firm in New York City. I had a phone interview with them, and then they invited me to New York City to interview in person. And basically, I told them, listen, I'm a clean slate. I have zero experience, you know, education-wise or professionally that will bias any of the work that I do. I will only know how to do what you teach me to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I'm like, I'm smart. I got an A- in organic chemistry. I can learn anything.
I got an A- in organic chemistry, Wall Street, here I come.
Yeah, exactly. And they're like, well, yeah, if you can learn that, I'm sure you can figure out what we do. And believe it or not, they offered me a job on the spot. And that day was what would have been my dad's 45th birthday. And so it just felt to me that I was on the right path. I had no idea what I was getting myself into, to be honest, but I knew that it paid well and that, you know, I'm smart enough and resourceful enough to figure things out.
Wow. That, and that's so symbolic. And so then from there, you went and became a certified financial planner and went on to become a CFA charter holder. Can you explain a little bit, what does CFA charter holder mean? We were talking about that a little bit before the show. I think most people know what a certified financial planner is, and we've talked about that before. But what is a CFA charter holder?
Yeah, so a CFA charter holder is someone who has gotten a lot more education and training in the much more technical aspects of investing. So whereas a CFP professional is kind of trained on all aspects of someone's financial life and putting a financial plan together and kind of this holistic financial planning perspective, a CFA charter holder really has a lot deeper training in different types of investments, different types of alternative investments specifically, and, you know, things like options and derivatives. And it's just a lot more technical investing training. Wow. Whereas someone who's a financial planner may go on to, you know, run a financial planning firm or be a financial advisor. Somebody that's a CFA charter holder generally is doing things kind of more on the side of running a mutual fund or working at a hedge fund or working at a big bank, for example.
Okay. So you've really done both. You've done the holistic kind of working with individual side and then also working with investments and some of the more complex, maybe not quite retail investor investment strategies, which is something that I want to talk a little bit about more because I know a lot of our listeners are interested in that. But before we get to that, I just want to stay a little more holistic and just talk about personal finance in general. You said that your boyfriend, now husband, was already kind of in finance. When did you really like start to understand or learn about personal finances for yourself? Was it in high school? Was it in college? Was it, you know, when you started pursuing, when you got this job at the hedge fund. When did you start to really understand personal finance?
Yeah. So I think I got kind of the school of hard knocks when my dad passed away. And I was just forced to, you know, make every dollar stretch as far as it possibly could. So, you know, I learned about budgeting. I learned about financial constraints back in the day. I understood what life insurance, because we didn't have it. And so I realized how valuable that, you know, could have been to us. But it wasn't really until after I graduated and I started working at this hedge fund that I started to understand kind of the larger nuances of, you know, investing in retirement planning and, you know, how to manage your cash flow appropriately if you have extra, which I had never had before, but now all of a sudden I was getting like a bonus and, you know, I had to start managing that and creating an emergency fund and whatnot. So it really wasn't until after I graduated, which is what was so frustrating to me, because I got into this world that I had never been exposed to before. And I started learning about all of these things and I was like, wait, this isn't rocket science. It's just that I've never been exposed to it. And my family, right. You know, a lot of my family members had never been exposed to it either, but it's not that difficult. But I felt like I was, you know, where I come from, people were at such a disadvantage financially because they had never been exposed to this information, which they were fully capable of understanding. And that's really what kind of ultimately led me to leave the job that I had and do what I do now.
And that makes sense, because your company Rise Up has your flagship program, LIT, L-I-T, designed for college students, especially TRIO and first generation low income individuals, as you say. What does that program teach you?
Yeah, so it's really designed to be the personal finance course that I wish I had had in college. So if I were to go teach personal finance at a university, this is what it is. And by making it virtual and video driven, I'm able to do that across the country all at the same time, rather than just being, you know, on staff at one university. And so it covers everything from money mindset, which is what we start with, because I believe that if you don't know what you want and you don't know where your relationship with money comes from, you're not going to be receptive to learning about things like budgeting or credit or investing. And then once you've kind of figured out what it is that you want and you've defined your goals for yourself, then we teach you about budgeting, about credit and loans, about taxes, insurance, investing, and retirement. And so it's right. It's really meant to get somebody from, you know, where I was when I first walked on campus as, you know, a low-income individual who was super stressed and intimidated by money, to getting your first job and confidently filling out that 401k enrollment form, because you've, you know, had this training and you've learned what it is that you need to do and how to define the goals that you have for yourself.
Wow. So there's a lot there. I want to dig in to one thing specifically, drill down real quick. Credit. What does credit mean? You mean credit cards? Like what is credit?
Yeah. So credit is actually our most comprehensive module, and it covers anything that a young person might encounter credit-wise. So we start with your credit score, what it is, how it's determined, how to build and boost your score, how to build credit as a young person. And then we talk about student loans. There's a 4-part series on student loans. We also talk about car loans or car notes. And we also talk about mortgages as well. And so it's meant to kind of make sure that people don't get themselves into trouble when it comes to debt, because there's lots of different ways to do that. And so we, you know, encourage people to form healthy habits and stay out of debt.
How do you boost your credit score?
Well, I guess if you don't have credit at all, which a lot of students don't, we encourage them to either apply for a secured card where they can put a defined amount of money onto a card and essentially spend it down like a debit card, but it impacts their credit score and builds credit history, or a student card, which usually has low rates, or do what I did, which is piggybacking, which my then boyfriend, now husband, so now my mother-in-law, allowed me to become a co-signer on one of her credit cards and basically just charged like toothpaste and deodorant to it every month. She paid the bill on time, so I was establishing good payment history, and then I just gave her cash anytime I saw her for what I owed her. But in terms of, you know, building your credit score, increasing your credit score, you have to understand what the major factors are. So your payment history is the largest factor. And so making sure that you're paying your bills on time every month is one of the largest determining factors.
What does that mean, paying it on time every month? Is it paying the minimum balance? Does it matter how much you pay every month?
I'm so glad you asked that. So technically, it is only the minimum balance. However, I tell people you should absolutely disregard the minimum balance. I think that's a ploy by the credit card companies to make money on interest. You should pay your bill off in full every month, either by the time that it's due or ahead of time. And the reason for that is if you don't pay off the entire balance, if you only pay that minimum balance due, what happens is the rest of that balance is still there next month, but it has friends with it. And those friends are called interest. And that's how the credit card companies make money, is by charging you interest on the balance that you don't pay off. So, you know, I don't believe that you should never use credit cards. We have a few that give us great rewards, but we pay our bill off every month in full. And I've never paid a cent of interest on any of my credit cards.
There you go. All right. So don't bring your, you know, your little friends, Billy, Jimmy, and Mr. Debt along with you.
Yeah, exactly.
And interest. Okay. So that's really great. Okay. So credit is important. Why? I mean, yeah. Why is a credit important?
Your credit score essentially is like a beacon out to the financial world about how responsible you are with money, more or less, specifically about borrowing money. And so if you have a good credit score, what that tells to different financial institutions like banks, or, you know, an auto loan company or whomever it is, or even like a place you might want to rent, like a leasing company, is that you're responsible with money, you pay your bills on time, and you haven't overburdened yourself with debt. When you have a low score, however, that says that you're not very responsible with credit or borrowing money or owing people money. And what happens then is that a low score costs you more. If you are viewed as someone who is a risky borrower or a risky tenant, that means that they're going to charge you more, either in interest or possibly in a security deposit or in insurance premiums, for example. They're going to charge you more because you're a riskier person to lend to or to lease to. So it ultimately costs you more. So it's in everybody's best interest to have as high a score as they possibly can.
Got it. Okay. And what do you think about people like, you know, Dave Ramsey followers who say that you shouldn't have a credit score at all. You shouldn't take out credit at all. You shouldn't need to borrow money. So you should just avoid credit cards outright. You think that's okay, but it's not necessarily, you don't have to go that extreme, or what do you think about it? Or do you think it's a bad idea?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I get asked this question a lot. I'm not anti-Dave Ramsey. I actually think that everyone's financial journey is their own. And ultimately, they need to find someone who they resonate with and whose mm-hmm. systems make sense to them, because otherwise they're never going to implement them, right? If
right.
you don't want to do it, or you're not inspired to do something, you're not going to make that change. And so if somebody thinks their views align with Dave Ramsey's and they want to be, you know, debt-free and only pay cash for things, you know, and have a $1,000 emergency fund and what have you, at least they're taking steps forward rather than just not doing anything at all. However, I think ultimately, once you get to the point where you're responsible enough managing your cash flow, which I think is ultimately Dave Ramsey's goal, mm-hmm. is to get people to recognize that they have money coming in, money going out, and that they're responsible for, you know, whether that's a positive or a negative at the end of the month. I think you can use credit cards, loans to your advantage, as I do. Like I said, you know, we get loads of credit card points just by spending and purchasing things that we would normally purchase. Whereas if we were to use our debit card or just cash, we would never get those points and those benefits. Mm-hmm. But it's really about forming those kind of micro habits initially to make sure that you are, you know, that you're going to be responsible with credit and not starting to use credit when, you know, you're in kind of a dangerous mindset where you're going to overspend and things like that. So personally, I think people need to kind of manage their cash flow, whether it's with cash or debit card to begin with, before they start really, you know, putting everything on a credit card.
Okay, great. I want to shift gears now to investing, because you have a lot of experience with investing. You're mentioning derivatives. Let's say I'm, you know, in my 20s, and I had mentioned before the show that a lot of people are investing in using Robinhood. Maybe some people are using Coinbase to invest in cryptocurrency. What is your opinion, first of all, on those apps? Like, what would your advice be to someone who's like, I want to invest in the stock market using Robinhood?
Yeah. So if you Google my name and the word Robinhood, some articles pop up over the last year or so. I've been pretty outspoken about it. And it's not that I dislike Robinhood. I think their mission is great. They're trying to democratize, you know, equity investing specifically. So investing in stocks, making it much more accessible for people who have, you know, small amounts of money to invest in the stock market. And I think that's a fantastic mission.
And they drove commission rates down to zero. I mean,
Yeah, across the board, across the industry. I mean, they've definitely been, you know, disruptive, which, you know, is a great sign from a, you know, any startup really, but specifically in the fintech space. However, with that kind of popularity and power really comes a lot of great responsibility, I feel. So to me, making something available to people who have literally had zero training or education about that particular topic before, making it available, one, but then number two, making it really sexy to them and exciting to them is kind of a dangerous combination. And so my issue with apps like Robinhood, for example, is how they're marketed to individuals, specifically young people. So they use specific words like supercharge and free and things like that, which young people who, you know, don't know otherwise take as risk-free and, you know, exciting and, oh, you know, it's basically a lottery ticket. It's going to make me rich. When in reality, that's not really the case. It can actually, you know, take your money much faster than it can make you money. And so what my general recommendation to people is, especially young people, is that your first foray into investing should really ultimately be womp womp for retirement. Right? That should be where your first investing dollars go.
I'm laughing at the womp womp.
Right? But it's true. Everybody like that. Whenever I say that, it sounds like a balloon's deflating afterwards. Like people are like, oh, that's not what I wanted to hear. But really, I mean, that is when you think about it, think about the course of your financial life. What are you working for, right? You're working to pay for things now, but ultimately you're working to save and invest to pay for your future self's needs so that you can stop working at some point, right?
And let me just say, you know, pretty much every single guest I've had on the show says the same thing, right? Invest in retirement. And I just want to make it like really clear. If you're not going to do that anyway, and you're going to, you know, use Robinhood, invest in the stock market, cryptocurrency, whatever, do it with a small amount of money. And you'll learn pretty quickly why you shouldn't do that with a large amount of money.
Yeah,
So if you're going to do it with a small amount of money. And if you make money at first, again, you know, stick with it. It took me all of a year to realize just how difficult, if not impossible, it is to come out with a net positive by investing in individual stocks in the stock market or in cryptocurrency. And even today with my, you know, kind of play money that I, just small amounts of money that I invest, I still come out about even. If I'm making any money, it's like 3%. Which is way lower than, you know, my retirement account that's invested in the boring but really valuable index funds. So some really great takeaways there. What do you think about cryptocurrency? I think Bitcoin is up to, last I checked, about $18,000. So if you had invested about a year ago when it was around $8,000, you would have more than doubled your money by now. That sounds really exciting. If you had invested, you know, 10 years ago, you would, depending on how much you invested, you'd be rich, right?
Well, but if you had invested in, you know, the fall of 2017, you'd still be down because it went up to, you know, higher than it is today. And it's actually lower than it was then because there was such a run on it. So it's all about timing and things. But as far as like cryptocurrencies go, I mean, I think people have to recognize that there's a major difference between something like cryptocurrency, which is new. It's considered an alternative asset, meaning it doesn't really operate, nor does it have kind of the trading history or the, you know, asset-backed value that things like stocks do.
Okay, could you explain what is asset-backed value? What does that mean? Because that's important.
Yeah. So when, you know, I'm analyzing a company, let's say a publicly traded stock, I'm looking at the company's balance sheet. So, you know, how much cash do they have on hand? How much are their facilities, real estate, brand name, things like that? How much is that actually worth? And then figuring out, okay, if this is what the company's value is kind of on paper, and this is how many shares they have outstanding, you can divide that value by the number of shares outstanding, and it gets you to a stock price, roughly, kind of like a bottom stock price, if you will. And so that to me tells me that, okay, there's roughly a floor here on this stock price, the price at which I think it won't go any lower than, because it has this just intrinsic value on its own. So if the company had to sell itself, for example, it could sell for at least this much, and I as a stockholder would not lose all of my money. So that's kind of how I look at stocks. But something like cryptocurrency doesn't have any real value. It's only, the value is really only determined by the people who are trading it and how much somebody, like the next trader is willing to pay for it. And so I have a really hard time investing in things that don't have any kind of tangible value, because it's just, it's incredibly difficult to come up with a price to pay for something like that when there's no, you know, financial statement to base that off of.
Absolutely. All right. This has been really great. We're out of time. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Tara. Again, this is Tara Falcone. You can find her at tarafalcone.com and at her company's website, riseupllc.com. That's RISUPLLC.com. Highly recommend you check her out and check out her programs and her resources. Thank you so much for your time, Tara.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.